We'll have some violence. Radiation. Putting out. Is it absolutely. Airport. But I haven't made you. Fly through. It's. Do you re-
Well, unfortunately, Ed, someone with way too much free time out there, just as a joke, I guess, wanted to block your signal. So, unfortunately, I don't know a simple solution. It's a shame you can't kind of plug in that HT into a nice linear amplifier.
I can, but not in the time involved. So just try again and hope.
Yeah, Ed, let's try one more time and then hope that the other person had his little joke and can move on from there.
I said basically the fear is defective cell phones spewing out broadband signals. The only way ham gear is tested for Part 15 emissions and have all kinds of requirements. It's because it all takes is one defective cell phone. I said, imagine your final approach to the Kennedy Airport in horrible weather. Your life depends upon the navigational system. Do you really want to risk somebody taking out a cell phone and all of a sudden losing your ability to follow your flight path?
Okay, I received all of that. That's great. Yeah, but I mean, can't you ultimately make the same case for any piece of electronic equipment that has an oscillator in it that could go haywire and completely crazy and spew RF into sensitive lines? You know, because that's what they used originally. I seem to recall that it wasn't only for cell phones. It was kind of everything electronic, and then finally, after people complained incessantly, they grudgingly opened it up for everything else but cell phones. So, again, I don't recall anything published, at least, that demonstrated a cause and effect. I understand the rationalization, but I think you can ultimately use the same rationalization for almost any modern electronic piece of equipment. I mean, not a toaster, because toasters don't need oscillators, but otherwise.
I think the answer is a large part of it was an abundance of caution, and if they accumulated more data, they were able to back off. WB2VH.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
I think if I remember, I think there was even an episode of MythBusters where they demonstrated that there really was no interference to the navigational equipment. I think I remember an episode of MythBusters where they showed that.
Yeah, I recall reading something on that. I didn't wasn't a regular watcher of MythBusters, so I didn't see the actual episode, but I seem to vaguely recall the story being told. Yeah, I got the sense that they didn't feel that it was inherent in the design, but that the risks were too high to warrant taking the chance. I think it's overkill, personally. You know, I mean, time will decide, and ultimately, I think the industry will design more bulletproof equipment that will obviate this, and it'll be a thing of the past. But, you know, it's a curious a technological aspect that's kind of still with us for dubious reasons, as far as I'm aware.
Well, my original question was that you can't use cell phone in the airplane because there is no signal there, so you cannot establish the connection. And that's why I was talking about 9/11. Once you don't have a chance to talk, why should you use it? Enter again.
Wait a minute. Every time the plane lands, everybody puts up their cell phone, and on the plane, they're talking to say, I landed.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
Yeah, thank you, Roy. Thank you, Ed. And there was no signal on that input over here as I was monitoring. In the beginning, I believe they felt there was a potential for interference. And as signals changed and technology changed on the airplanes, equipment and everything, I believe that also they just don't want people running over each other socially and interpersonally with so much communication devices. They set it up to relax and go. And why do you have to be the one person out of 125 who's not making noise communicating? KD2FIU.
Well, George, it's a very good explanation and a very good reason. It's not anything I ever read anyplace, and it kind of goes against the nature of business in general. I mean, I sort of, in a way, wish there was something like that available for the subway systems. More than a few times, I've sat down next to someone with one of those wonderful Bluetooth things in their ears, and they're having one half of a conversation right next to me. So it would be nice to kind of have that cone of silence. But all the published reasons that I've ever read for the limitations, you know, the reason why iPhones have a special airplane mode that cuts out their transceiver systems is they've said because of electronic equipment might be interfered with. Not necessarily they will be interfered with, but they might be interfered with. And so that's the reason why I've always seen the airline industry used. I haven't heard the social reason. Although, again, I would like to see that happen to the train system. That would be nice not to have people having one-sided chats next to me on a subway.
Roy, I have a question for you.
Yes, Ed.
You ever seen a high-power vacuum-tube amplifier with parasitic chokes on the plate connection?
I've seen them in YouTube, but I've never seen them in person.
You admit to their existence?
Yes.
They're there to prevent you from transmitting out-of-band parasitics. That's what they're worried about on the plane.
WS.
Okay, it's a reason. It's not an absurd reason. Again, I kind of think that you could extend that reason for a lot of other electronic equipment that they don't, because they've gotten too much complaints. People want to use their iPhones, their tablets, their Kindles, whatever. So they've kind of compromised and decided that they'd settle for shutting down the cell transceiver and the Wi-Fi transceiver. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, all the cell phones I've had, you have the airplane mode when that's only for going to movie theaters or a concert. You just always put it into airplane mode. It's called airplane mode. That means you get on a plane and put it on airplane mode. That's what it's there for. Back to you.
Yeah, because that's, we're discussing the reason why they came up with airplane mode.
KB2IQN with a comment.
Yes, Chris.
Thank you, gentlemen. The cell phone, the situation with the cell phone in the air airplane is a little bit more complicated, because the base station antennas for the cell phone system are designed to be sort of a pancake pattern. If you actually look at the antennas that are used, they're focused more at the horizon, not up in the air. And when a cell phone is up in the air in a plane, it sees hundreds of cell base stations, not just one. And so you've got this complicated situation of a cell phone system on the ground designed for the ground, and then a cell phone up in the air, like looking at a whole lot of cell sites on the ground. They've, for airplanes, at least at one time, they had essentially the like sort of a cell spot they'd have inside of the airplane with a high directivity beam back to the ground. And I don't really know what happened to that system. It was expensive and it was a little bit complicated. And lately, the last few times I've taken air flights, like they basically said to turn the cell, you put your cell phones into airplane mode and not use them. So that's what I think is sort of going on. There's sort of like a competing thing where there was like a commercial use of cell phones on planes with like a local cell spot versus having a whole lot of cell phones trying to connect to systems on the ground. That's my best guess, at least right now. KB2IQN.
Okay, thanks a lot for that, Chris. Wesley, I think ultimately what it amounts to is you do not probably have a perfect connection to cell towers because of the location and the speed. But if for some reason the airline industry didn't try, originally the airline industry, as Chris sort of mentioned, had a commercial telephone line that if you paid an exorbitant fee, they ran it through their electronics, and that was kind of agreed on their part to a degree, and maybe protecting their electronic equipment. Now they've turned out your cell phone at least while the plane is flying to connect to cell towers. But more likely than not, if you actually didn't upset the stewardess and you secretly turned it on, depending upon where you were at any time, it's possible that you would connect to a cell tower. It might not be the best connection in the world, but I don't really find it hard to believe that these guys in the middle of being killed, when the stewardesses had other things on their mind than to worry about cell phones, that they made a decent connection and it was recorded.
During time of 9/11, the GSM network was one of the greatest and most used with all of the formats they have been used, and it's alive till today. So if the communication wasn't possible, isn't possible right now when you're on the air, whether because you can see multiple sites or whether because all of the antennas are simply emitting the signal down to the ground and 500 feet up in the air you don't have a signal, or your receiver in your cell phone is not able to tune to the particle one because it sees so many of them, then we may say that all of those recordings looks kind of strange from the plane that was about to crash because there was no communication by technical means. And that's what actually was my question. I have never found, I never met anyone who would say, I had a cell phone conversation in the plane while in the air. Not even one of them. And I flight frequently so many times. And twice.
Yes, which you're not allowed to, and you get into a hell of a lot of trouble if you try.
Yeah, I sort of agree with Ed. I mean, the bottom line, and I really don't know the specifics. I am not a cell phone specialist, and I am not an aeronautics specialist. But if it was impossible to communicate using cell phones, I think at the very beginning, there wouldn't be a problem getting people to stop using cell phones. So the fact that they felt that cell phones were being used, they must have gotten some connection. Otherwise, why would you waste your time on something that didn't work? And why would you have to have rules to disallow things that don't work anyway? So my gut sense is that it might have not been the perfect connection, but at times it worked. And probably while the plane was going down, it was near enough a cell tower or two that it was able to transfer the audio and have it recorded. I might be wrong on this. Again, not a specialist, but that's how it seems to me.
Also, the plane probably wasn't up that high.
And also, it may have they may have been using the in-flight system to actually make a connection from the in-flight cell system rather than the cell phone in their pocket.
miles. I'm afraid I don't believe that, but you could be right, so I just find that rather difficult to believe.
2 Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich?
Because a combination of a whole bunch of things. I think in the beginning they didn't know what they had, and they didn't know if it was going to knock off any navigation systems, but they couldn't take a chance. And when they found out that that wasn't so, I think it moved over to what George was saying, a social thing, where they didn't want, you know, 125 people talking to their brother-in-laws about when they were going to land. They didn't want to collectively transmitting either. They didn't want 125 cell phones collectively transmitting, because that may, in fact, have knocked off navigation systems. But, Roy, I think you're right. I don't think it was ever proven, and that's why they don't hit on it too hard with other electronics, you know, now.
Okay, so basically we'll have to agree to disagree. I think, although not perfect, it's probably possible at times to communicate using a cell phone if the stewardess didn't knock it out of your hand, because otherwise I can't really see why they would disallow it if it wasn't possible to do in the first place. Again, might be wrong. So we'll agree to disagree that you believe that it's inoperable in the air, as Ed mentioned. You know, they were in the middle of crash landing, so they were probably significantly close to the ground. So that's also an aspect that you have to keep in mind.
We know they work inside the plane at the terminal when everybody says, "I've landed."
Yes, that also, Ed. Yeah, that's true. And, you know, again, it sort of depends on things. I don't think it's a reliable means. The airline industry tried to make a lot of money by having a much more efficient means of doing it and then charging you a heck of a lot. That kind of didn't really take off because, you know, people were already not terribly pleased with the cost of the tickets and such. I think that's what going on here, personally. But we'll table it for the time being. I just want to give out the information once again before we move to Paul's space report. So anyone want to kind of close this on any statement, please feel free.
Well, I believe the communication was possible with my experience for the past 30 years. Getting all changes in cellular technology somewhere in mid-1997. After that, there was, with the 1,000 people that I spoke to and I flight with, and there was never one single situation that somebody would conform. He had been able to make a cell phone conversation in the air. Now, at that time of the crisis, the only explanation that makes sense is that there was on-flight communication system that allowed those people to communicate. But if there was none, what can I say? It's a tragedy of the people, and calling it fake would be unfair and would be absolutely ridiculous. But it is an unexplained. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy.
You're welcome, Wesley, and thank you to everyone who participated for this segment of the Technical Net. Once again, I want to remind everyone that if you have any mailbag questions or topics you would like to hear discussed, or you want to hear some subject mentioned in the Science Talk segment, or you have a puzzle for me, or you don't agree with something that I said and can cite a reference to repute it, or if there's an article or website or a YouTube that you think that that Paul, WS2N, would be interested in discussing for the Space Report. The email address that you can reach me, and I respond almost immediately to emails. I'm a very good email person. Some people kind of delay their email responses to weeks, months, or years. But the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com.
Links to the articles that I mentioned will be soon available on roy.ac2gs.com. And there's still that chat room available to you, chat.ac2gs.com. And this audio stream is available on the internet at technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, the last 14 years of 38 years worth of the technical net is available on my KC2NJI site, amateurradio.tv. And once again, a reminder for everyone, this Friday, May 29th at 9 p.m., we will start our little radio wake in memory of a great man, Dick Nadel, K2RIW, who manned this TechNet for 38 years nonstop. I don't know if this guy ever took a vacation. So we're going to have the opportunity to talk about what a great guy he is, was, and what he taught us, and what he told us, and what we learned from him. So I hope most of you, if not all of you, will remember to come and join me this Friday at 9 p.m., and we'll keep it going until we run out of nice things to say. I have the word of the president that the repeater isn't going to be shut down that night, so it'll go past midnight. So I hope you'll all be there and join me in that. I want to pass on to Paul, WS2N, so that he can do his space report. So you're up next, Paul.
AC2GS, WS2N, thanks, Roy. Good topic tonight. And, I want to, what if I went onto an airplane with a big shell cell, you know, with a 12-volt battery, my Kenwood 440 and a Kia, started hooking it up. How far do you think for that stewardess would rip that radio out of my hand? You just can't do it. But they don't like any electronics on the airplane. I remember the story about the local oscillator and some radio, and I think that led to a plane crash or suspected of a plane crash. But, you know, safety first. Remember, everybody used to smoke. Those days are over. This is a interesting SpaceNet report. The main topic tonight is two Americans are going to launch from Launch Complex 39A this Wednesday. I've been talking about this for weeks and weeks, and actually for years. They've been developing this system. SpaceX and NASA has teamed up to create the Crew Dragon vehicle. And that's what Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken are going to be flying in. Interesting, Bob Behnken is a ham radio operator. His call is KE5GGX. And he'll be, him and Doug will be traveling to the International Space Station. And they'll be on top of a SpaceX Falcon 9 booster. And it's the best edition of the booster that they've ever had. They've gone through three or four iterations of the boosters over the years since they started launching this. And they recovered them, and they reused them, and they recovered them, and on. But in this case, this will be the first time this booster will be used, and they will recover it. They'll have... It'll be sitting there waiting to catch the booster on the way down, and they'll reuse that booster. And that's around 150 feet tall, around 12-foot diameter. It's got four big legs that come out. And they will be trying to catch that one in the ocean. It lands and it stays up vertically, and they bring it back to shore. It's not like they lay it down out in the ocean. That's the way it comes back. And meanwhile, the second stage... another Merlin engine. They're called Merlin engines. The Falcon 9 consists of Merlin D engines. Nine on the first booster and one on that second booster that's going to push them to orbit. They'll be they'll be flying, you know, just a very short amount of time, I think less than a day, to dock with the International Space Station. Now, if something should happen, they have on board a launch abort system. And the launch abort system doesn't look like the old-fashioned ones that the original Apollo had, or the original Mercury mission. They had a launch abort system with a tractor type of system which would be attached to the top of the vehicle. And if there was an emergency, that would pull them away from an exploding booster, either on a pad or going uphill to orbit. The crew vehicle has these eight Super Draco engines, so they're all fueled up. They're with inside the spacecraft itself, and if you mix these hypergolic fuels together, hydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide, you don't need a spark or anything, and they'll just ignite, and this thing would take off, would push the vehicle away from the booster. So it's a pusher system as opposed to a pulling tractor system. So, and if it, you know, burst discs now that will blow, and the two fuels will mix together, and it'll be. And they'll successfully dock with the International Space Station. They have three people up there now, one American, Chris Cassidy, and two Russians. So after docking, they'll have five. They plan on staying attached to the space station for a couple of months. And since it's the first time they're doing this with a crew, they have done it without a crew once. They sent up another crew vehicle. Two marches ago, it went up and without a crew, docked with the space station, stayed there for a while. The crew that was on board the space station went inside, checked everything out, left, closed the doors, and then the vehicle left and came back and splashed down in the ocean. And this time they have a crew. After a couple of months, Doug and Bob will get into the Dragon vehicle, undocked from the space station, and deorbit. They have a trunk attached to the spacecraft. It's as big as the spacecraft itself. The trunk will separate. The trunk consists of the main thing. It has solar panels all over it, and it's attached to the vehicle itself. They don't have big panels that open up like they used to have on all the cargo vehicles that went up. They've done away with that. Instead of panels opening up, the solar panels are directly attached to the body of the trunk of the spacecraft. So they'll deorbit, and the trunk will separate, and then you'll just have the crew vehicle itself. It'll come through the atmosphere. It has a Piker, what they call it, a Piker X heat shield, come through the atmosphere, and will land in the Atlantic Ocean. If you follow SpaceX and all the 20 cargo vehicles that have gone up to the space station, they all came down and landed near California in the Pacific Ocean. And SpaceX has a ship there, and they bring the cargo vehicle back that way. But in this case, it's the Atlantic Ocean. Now, why the Atlantic Ocean? One main reason is that's where they're launching from. They're launching from Florida. And if there's an abort, the Super Draco engines have to fire. They'll be coming down in the Atlantic Ocean, and they'll be picked up by SpaceX's ship that will be located there. And that will be it. They expect a good-sized crowd in Florida. Even so, the virus numbers are still going up. They don't care that people will be showing up. Hopefully they stay 6 feet apart. And originally the vice president was going to show up and... probably, without a doubt, make next... And instead of going to, you know, to the NASA site, which I normally do, to watch all these launches, I'm sure they'll probably be on every channel you could think of. It's a big deal because we haven't launched anybody from the United States since 2010 when Atlantis went up for the last time. And, you know, space shuttles did 135 flights. And the final flight was, you know, it's like almost 10 years ago now. But this has been in development, and hopefully it all goes well. If it does, in the fall of this year, they'll make sure the spacecraft is good, sound, and they'll be sending another spacecraft up in the fall. And this time, instead of two, they'll have four. They'll have three Americans, and they're going to bring up one fellow from Japan. We're partners with all these countries, Japan and European Space Agency is involved, and there'll be in the future astronauts from different countries, Germany. They'll eventually have a system. You know, they'll go up four at a time. And Russia will still be sending three at a time, and that will eventually create a permanent crew of seven on board the space station. For the last probably 8 years or so, it's been a crew of six. By doing that, you have enough people to maintain the space station, and this extra person will actually double the amount of science time that's going to be allocated for the space station. I mean, that's the ultimate purpose of the space station, to do science. And they figure with that extra person now, you know, that he doesn't need to really put time in with the space station. It'll be maintained, and he'll be able to add another 45 hours to the time, which right now that's about all they get, 45 hours. So they'll be up to like 90 hours or 100 hours of actual science being done by the crew. So before I move on, is there any questions about this launch or the crew going up? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report on the TechNet.
Question, KC1SAM.
Good evening, Sam. KC1SAM. Go ahead.
Don't fall. The capsule containing the two crew members, if there's an emergency and that thing takes off to save them, did you say that will land on that ship that's out in the Atlantic? Is that where that goes?
No, the ship, which is about the size of a football field, it's got a name. Of course, I Still Love You is the name of the ship. And that's for the booster. It's 150-foot-long, 12-foot-diameter booster that will land vertically, that they've been doing successfully now for around 50 times, 50 times. So they've gotten real good at it. Once in a while, they miss. But that has nothing to do with crew. As this rocket goes up, that first stage booster will separate. It'll get up around 3,000-4,000 miles an hour, and that booster will come back. Then the second stage ignites, and that's got the also another Merlin D engine on it, and that pushes them to orbit. So any time going uphill, including on a pad, if there's an emergency and they have to abort, the Super Draco engines, which are located with inside the spacecraft itself, will ignite. And let's say it's on a pad, they'll be, you know, wind up a couple of miles out in the Atlantic Ocean, and they'll be recovered by the Space Force that's now out there. They call it the 45th Wing. that's what they do. I mean, it's all part of NASA. They come out of Patrick's Air Force Base, and they have ships all over the place, you know, different locations. In case this vehicle comes down, you know, they have different abort locations right near the pad. Probably, I believe, North Carolina, just east of North Carolina. And then if they're going really uphill and it's still attached to the second booster, need to abort. I mean, they could abort and they could actually wind up, they say, near Ireland in the Atlantic Ocean. And then if they keep going and it's too late, they can't abort to the ground. They abort to orbit, they call it, and that means they'll just get into orbit if there's something wrong, and then, you know, just stay in orbit until they figure out what to do. Either get the problem repaired and continue on to the space station, or, you know, turn around and fire your retro rockets and land back in the Atlantic Ocean, you know, a couple of orbits from now. So that's their choices. And the interesting part is, you know, on the launch pad itself, there was a lot of discussions when they were developing the system. SpaceX wanted to let the crew in and then fuel the rocket, you know, put all their kerosene in. That's really what it is. It's RP-1 rocket propellant number one. It's really kerosene and liquid oxygen. And they wanted to do it after the crew was in the vehicle. And NASA, and I remember Stafford, he's an old-time astronaut, they said, you know, we always would fuel the vehicle, then we would put the crew in and launch, you know. But SpaceX has gotten around that, and what their system is the, you know, the vehicle will be unfueled. Bob and Doug will get into the crew vehicle, and then at that time, the hatchway will be closed, and the arm, the swing arm, will pull away. When the swing arm pulls away, they'll activate the abort system. So if something goes wrong before launch, they'll be able to abort from the pad. Now, since it's activated and ready to go, they could now load the fuel into the vehicle, first stage, second stage, and if something should blow on a pad, they will be able to get away from it. Even so, they're fueling. And that's how the system is supposed to work. Once it's all fueled up, ready to go, usually within a half hour, they have roughly a half hour after it's completely fueled to launch. But in this case, it's on-time launch. The window is like within seconds, and that's because as the space station is directly overhead, that means their inclination, this 51.5 degree inclination will be set, and off they go. You know, if they went any other time, you know, they wouldn't match the inclination, and no matter what they do, they would never be able to dock with the space station. So if it doesn't go on time, that's it. They'd have to have at least a 24-hour delay, you know, for Thursday or something. Unless it was a real problem, and then they would just, you know, scrub the whole thing. So depending on weather, I don't know, you know, really what the long-term forecast is for Florida. But a lot of people are going to be down at Cocoa Beach, I'm sure, watching this. You know, and then as time goes on, as the years go on, you know, people, you know, won't find that to be as interesting, I don't think. And, you know, you'll always get a crew, you know, people watching. This is sure going to be broadcast, that's for sure. And we'll get away from the Russians. The Russians, we pay them, what is it, they're up to $85 million a seat to launch from Russia. And we now will be getting away from that. And we have another vehicle being built by Boeing That should come online by the end of the year or maybe early next year. So we'll always have a backup, you know. If there's something wrong with the Crew Dragon, we'll have a, they call it Starliner by Boeing. Any questions or comments? And as a ham, I hope Bob Benkin will have time to make contacts with students back in the States, KE5, TGX. And I don't know if Doug got a call. He didn't have one like a year or so ago, but sometimes they rush it toward the end to make sure they get a call. And then they could use the Aries system. And that's always great. Right now, they have this COVID problem. And you can't put a whole school and class together to sit and watch the astronauts, you know, 10 or 12 minute window and have the kids ask questions sitting in a big auditorium. That's out. So now they're doing it virtually. So the last class that they did, Chris Cassidy has a call letter as well. He's the one that's up there now. And he did an Aries contact with the children in Canada, and they had one location where the signals come down, and then that station wherever it might be, Italy, or they have one in New Hampshire, I think. Definitely have one in California. I remember using that one for a class that we did. And they'll come down on that link, and then they retransmit it out through the telephone system, and it usually goes to a school. Well, in this case, they had dozens of kids that would have normally been together, and each one was in their own home, and they were transmitting the signal of Chris Cassidy virtually to, well, you know, the same amount of kids, but They all got to ask questions, and from what I read on the Aries website, it went very well. Maybe they'll do that, you know, the same thing with Bob Benkin. I don't know. Maybe by that time, you know, we'll be up to face. Another launch I'm waiting for is July 17th, and that will be the Mars Perseverance rover that will be launched also from Cape Kennedy, not from Launch Complex 39, but from Launch Complex 41, and that's the launch complex that's used by the United Launch Alliance, ULA, which is Boeing and Lockheed together. They're partners on that system, and they'll be launching the Atlas V rocket on top of the Atlas V rocket, which has been very successful, like, you know, 100 launches or so, and they just, you know, 100%, they've never failed with an Atlas V rocket. So on top of that, they're going to put this rover that's going to fly to Mars, and, you know, over, I think it's a 2,300-pound vehicle on Earth anyway. It's going to be weighs 0.38 or one-third of the weight on Mars. We'll be landing in Jezero crater, and that would be in early February when it lands. So it'll go up in July, and in February it'll land on Mars. And I follow the all the testing and everything that they've done over the years with this vehicle. And it's very similar to the Curiosity one. It kind of looks like that. It's a little bit bigger, a little bit heavier. You know, but it's got six wheels, and it's got a little different wheels, better upgraded wheels. They had problems with Curiosity's wheels. Felt some holes in it. And they have a way around that now. But, you know, hopefully it gets to Mars okay. It's got an oxygen creating machine on board called Moxie. Moxie is the they plan on making like a liter of oxygen, seeing if that system works. Take the air out of Mars, which is mostly carbon dioxide, separate. Interesting thing of that flight, you know, regular listen to the net, I've talked about the helicopter that's also on board. And the helicopter will detach from the bottom of the rover. The rover will pull away. And then eventually, I think it's going to get like 300 feet away from it or something. And then the helicopter will eventually make some flights, you know, powered by electricity. It's got a solar panel on top. So that should be interesting. And that's a July 17th launch. Hopefully that gets off okay. There's another launch by Japan sending something to Mars for the United Emirates. They built a spacecraft called Hope. So that's going to be another Mars mission right around the exact same time as Perseverance launch. And not to be outdone, China plans on launching a vehicle as well, which will contain an orbiter, a lander, and a rover. So they're hoping that works. European Space Agency had planned on launching a vehicle from French Guiana down in South America, and they were going to launch a rover to Mars, but they've had some problems with their parachute. And parachute didn't work out too good. JPL tried to help them out, Jet Propulsion Laboratory with NASA, and they can't get it together in time, so they're going to have to wait 2 years until the orbits of Mars and Earth are close together. But they just tested Perseverance parachute last week. Did a final test on it, and then, it's a big parachute. It's around 70 feet in diameter. It's got to be able to open up at supersonic speeds, I think around 1,300 miles an hour. It's got to be able to deploy. And they've gone through a lot of testing with that parachute. I remember a couple of years ago, I talked about it on the net. They launched from a sounding rocket from Virginia, from Wallops Island, Virginia, Black Grant rocket. They put it on top of a rocket, went straight up, I think around 600 miles, turned around, and came back and actually lit a rocket engine to try to get up more speed and to try to see if they could come through at the same speed that they would be entering a Mars atmosphere with. They did it at the same altitude where the same pressures would be. This way they're duplicating the pressures on Mars, and the 70-foot parachute opened up perfectly, and it was a success. So that was the main test. They just tested another one other time. They pack it so tight, you know, they crunch up this parachute and all the Kevlar ropes and lines, and it winds up in a small, like, cylinder. The cylinder is so packed, they said it's like the density of oak. That's how it's packed in there. And they have this mortar on the top of it. When the vehicle is in the aeroshell coming down through Mars. You have to separate the aeroshell to get rid of that. And this thing's got to be able to pull the parachute out. And his mortar goes off, pyrotechnics, and lights that thing. And that thing comes out at lightning speed. And hopefully it works. It worked for Curiosity, but Curiosity was a little lighter vehicle. Hopefully it goes well. Any questions or comments? This is WS2M.
Have a question, KC1SAM.
Yes, Sam, go ahead.
Since Perseverance is a rover, and probably a pretty decent one since they've made a lot of improvements, and the helicopter is extremely limited, what can the helicopter do that the rover can't? Wherever the helicopter goes, the rover can probably go there. So what's the actual purpose of the helicopter?
For now, it's, you know, this is a proof of concept. They want to see if this works. They want to be able to see if they can fly this thing on another planet. If that's successful, of course, it would be the first time that anything's ever flown on another celestial body. And, of course, the air is very thin. And if the blades are 4 feet long, you have two blades, and one goes counterclockwise, the other one goes clockwise. And on top of that, they have the solar panel. So it's not like a drone, you know, like with these four blades. It's really more like a small helicopter. The helicopter itself, I think, weighs 5 pounds, so it's very light. And the idea, of course, would be to, you know, as the rover is going, you know, we have a choice of going left, right, stay down the middle. Usually they have a good idea of what's going on from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter or Mars Odyssey. You know, they're up there still taking pictures. They're orbiting Mars and they're looking down, and they get terrific pictures. You know, if you had a card table, you know, sitting on a planet on from orbit, so they know roughly what's there. But let's say they wanted to get a more detailed view. You know, you could have this helicopter flying ahead and say, well, let's go left and right. You know, there might be just too much sand that way. We don't want to get stuck. And they expect to get around 5 flights out of this thing. So, I mean, after a couple of months, or probably three, 4 months or so, that this will come to a grinding halt. And, although NASA, you know, the thing keeps flying, they'll use it over and over until it don't work anymore. Back to you, Sam.
KC1SAM. All right, proof of concept. I couldn't figure why, you know, because the rover can do it with four wheels on the ground, so to speak, you know. Okay, actually, yeah, once it works, I guess then you can do a lot in the future. Thanks, Paul.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, and six wheels. It's six-wheeled vehicles. And made of aluminum, titanium, and aluminum. I think it's titanium spokes. But I'm looking for, on these wheels, I'm looking to see if they have the same setup that they had on the two earlier rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, and also on Curiosity. They've all developed it to JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. And on the wheels, the outer wheels, they have these holes in the wheels themselves. There's a lot of holes in the wheels. It's all metal. It's not like inflated with nitrogen or air or anything. It's these big metal wheels. They have these holes, and you have in Morse code JPL. You know, da 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 da, da 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 did, and then da da did it. You know,
that time complete.
It's on the wheel. So as the wheels roll on the surface, you know, every time it makes another turn, you see these JPL keeps getting printed out in CW on the surface. And then they have all these cameras. Curiosity had 17 cameras. This thing's got 25 cameras. And but you know, you could see, you know, you look ahead and you can actually see the imprint on the ground, and it really helps them determine, calibrate things when they see that. But I saw pictures of this one. I didn't see the JPL on the wheels, so I'll have to look for that in the future. What it does have is a couple of microphones. It does have two microphones. Yeah, they tried microphones years ago on a Mars Polo Lander, and the Mars Polo Lander crashed. That didn't work out. And then when the Phoenix went up, they didn't put a microphone on that one. I was unhappy about that. And then with the InSight that's on the planet now, that's just sitting there, that's not a rover. They figured out a way to use the system on board to, try to duplicate what the sounds of Mars. But this is going to have high quality microphones, two of them. One, when it's coming down for the landing, so you'll be able to hear the pyrotechnics go off and anything clicking or clanking and whatever, even a wind as the vehicle comes through the atmosphere. It'll record all of that and eventually transmit it back to Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter in orbit around Mars, and then MRO will eventually send it back to the Deep Space Network on Earth. And that'll be interesting. And then, now, that whole setup all goes away. Your sky crane and everything flies away after it lands. It's got a parachute, well, first of that heat shield comes down, and then it has a parachute, 70-foot diameter parachute. And then below that, they have these, eight rockets, eight pulsing rockets. And it's a sky crane, and below that is the vehicle itself. And they have these cables that drop down around 50 feet, and now this thing is dangling from this rocket-powered sky crane, and then the wheels actually touch ground. And then the second they touch ground, it sends a signal, pyrotechnics go off, and the sky crane flies away, about a mile and a half away from the vehicle. And then Perseverance will be, on the surface. Now, Perseverance has a microphone. Had one on the vehicle that flew away, and now they have another one. So as the years go on, hopefully, as this thing operates, every now and then they'll, be able to send recordings back of what they're hearing, maybe a dust double is going to go by, or maybe a piece of equipment will be making noise, and you might be able to hear the wheels doing something. And again, you could say, well, what's the purpose of that, too? What's the idea of that? And the idea, of course, is what I just said, but if there's something wrong, something mechanically wrong, or something up, and they could pick up the noise that's going on, that might help them determine, what the problem is, and it's actually a good idea to have a microphone on board the rover. Any comments, questions? This is WS2N. And, we had a couple other topics, but we could always wait until next week with that. And I'm going to turn it back over to Roy and see if he has anything further. But usually we start to close down 11 or so. And the good thing is the repeater stays up until 12, so if anybody wants to use it afterwards, you can. The old time, we used to go to 12 o'clock, and you had about 2 or 3 minutes after we got off, and the repeater would shut itself down, and that was it. Now we have this, extra 45 minutes or so that it still remains open. Roy, I'm going to turn it over to you. AC2GS, this is WS2N.
KD2FIU.
George, is that for me or for Roy?
Oh, that's for Paul, and thank you very much for all the information. You bring a lot of info that would take us a lot of time to research on our own. Kudos to you, KD2FIU. Thanks, Paul.
Anytime, George, yes. Thanks for that. We'll keep doing this as long as we can, as long as Limoc lets us. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. We'll give people some time to use the repeater after I kind of close things for.